you know. But I do want us to, I do want to point out something I don't think we have pointed out, because we were talking about Nehemiah and Ezra and the return of the exiles from that area. And if we wonder sometimes why in the book of Esther God is never mentioned, you know, that we don't find him mentioned at all in the book of Esther, one of the clues may be that the exiles who have gone back to Israel, both waves, have already gone back to Israel. The people who chose to go back to Israel have left. So, not everybody went back. And so Mordecai and Esther and all of them are people who chose not to go back. So, you know, are descendants of people who chose not to go back. So there's still a Jewish identity, but not particularly always a religious one, you know, a cultural one. Although what happens affects the Jewish culture to this day, and we'll see that. When we were finishing last week in chapter 8, Esther had risked her life again to go before the king, because even though Haman was dead, the law that he had written and sent out to all the provinces and all the nationalities within the empire, that on a certain day, everybody could freely attack and loot and, you know, plunder and kill the Jews, with the idea of exterminating all the Jews all over. And that would include all the Jews in Israel and in Palestine and all of that. And even though Haman was dead, all of that was still in the works. That was still, it was an unrevocable law that had been granted. So Esther now goes before the king, and the king is thinking this is all over, Haman's dead, everything's happy, and she then says, you know, he grants her favor again, doesn't, you know, she could be killed for showing up without being asked, but he asks her again, what would you like up to half the kingdom, and she basically says that you would spare my life and the life of my people. You know, they're like, what? You know, that was came as a shock, and to realize that the law that Haman had written and passed was about the Jews, and that Esther was a Jew. So this is, a lot of this is probably all new to him. So what he does is he passes a law. He says at once the royal secretaries were summoned, and on the 23rd day of the month of Sivan, they wrote out all Mordecai's orders to the Jews and to the satraps and governors and nobles of all 127 provinces stretching from India to Kush. So from India to Africa, this is a wide-ranging empire, in every single province, in every single language, in every single nationality. You got to remember, they were very diverse. And so he made sure he did that. And he gave Mordecai, now who's being honored, to write a law to deal with that law. They couldn't revoke it, but they had to find a way to deal with it. So Mordecai gets to do all of that. And so he gives Mordecai the permission to do it. And in verse 11, it says, the king's edict granted the Jews in every city the right to assemble and protect themselves, to destroy, kill, and annihilate any armed force of any nationality or province that might attack them and their women and children, and to plunder the property of their enemies. So what the implication of that is, the law that Haman had written and sent out, the Jews were supposed to be unaware, caught by surprise, but they really didn't even have a right to defend themselves. That the right of law was on the right of those who would destroy them, so the Jews would be violating the law even if they defended themselves. So what Mordecai does is he writes a law saying, okay, you have the right to assemble and to defend yourself, and not only to defend yourself, but to destroy anybody who attacks you and plunder. Basically flips it. Says they still have the right to attack you. Doesn't rescind that. Those people still have the right. The law says that on that day, that's what they're supposed to do if they choose to do it. He just says to the Jews, you now have the right to defend yourself. And he says, a copy of the text of the edict was issued as law in every province and made known to the people of every nationality so the Jews would be ready. And it says, the couriers riding on royal horses raced out, spurred on by the king's command, and the edict was also issued in the citadel of Susa. So they issued this out, and the royal riders went out at full speed. And you get the idea, by the king's command, you know, it was do this and do this now, because it's going to take a little while. They're in you know, Iraq, Iran, right in that area, and they've got to go all the way as far east as India, and all the way through the Promised Land and over into Northern Africa. It's going to take a little while. A horse is about as fast as you can get there, and they're not going to run those horses, you know. So it's going to take a while for all of this to get spread out, for the news to be, once they get there, they have to make it known, they have to make sure every nationality knows. So it gives them some time. And when they do that, it says, Mordecai left the king's presence, wearing the royal garments of blue and white, a large crown of gold, and a purple robe of linen, and the city of Susa had a joyous celebration. Mordecai walked out wearing everything, you know, the Haman's estate had been given to Esther. Now, remember, Haman had said he would put up 10 talents of silver to pay for the annihilation of the Jews. And 10 talents of silver is like $60 million. So he, you know, all of that, his whole estate is given to Esther. And his position of honor and control and in power is given to Mordecai. And the fact that the city of Susa held a joyous celebration tells you Haman wasn't very well liked. You know? And he says, and in every province and every city wherever the edict of the king went, there was joy and gladness among the Jews and feasting and celebrating. You know, and many people of other nationalities became Jews because fear of the Jews had seized them. So people, it says, became Jews. Well, how do you become a Jew? You're supposed to be born into it. Well, there was a proselyting and all kinds of things. Well, we need to understand and fully recognize is that while Judaism per se is a race, a nationality, an ethnic of people who are descendants one from another, there have been influxes of groups into that, you know, that into that over the years at different times, and who have, you know, right at the very beginning they'd be proselytes, but two generations they're Jews like everybody else. In fact, some historians even suggest that the very extreme, if you see the really extreme Hasidic Jews, that comes from a group of people who, after some of the pogroms in Eastern Europe had destroyed many of the Jews, and they had watched what had happened and seen how the Jews reacted, became Jewish, and they weren't even in the bloodline. That this is another group, a foreign group, who became Jewish and actually adopted some of the most, some of the strictest, most stringent sides of it, reflecting their culture. So there was a lot that happened here. Now, the timing of it is very important. When the edict went out, we're reading this and it's all like boom, 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 you know. But they actually had 8 months from the time the edict went out to that day, which would be in the spring in March. You know, the Jewish months are a little different, so it changes every year. But it would be about like in our March, February and March, that this would take place. The Jews actually had 8 months to get ready because the other law still stood. Anybody who wanted to join that side and attack and plunder the Jews could attack them, kill them, take their property, you know, and they had the power of law behind them. But now the Jews had the power to defend themselves. And evidently, because of how that was written at the end of chapter 8, Jews were pretty popular. And they, you know, in getting ready for defending themselves, there were people who were fearful of them to the point where they became part of them. So, you know, it's a flip now. So now it's just not one group attacking this hopeless, helpless, defenseless people. It's been arranged so they can defend themselves. So in chapter 9, on the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar, the edict commanded by the king was to be carried out. On this day, the enemies of the Jews hoped to overpower them, but now the tables were turned, and the Jews got the upper hand over those who hated them. The Jews assembled in their cities all over the provinces of King Xerxes to attack those seeking their destruction. No one could stand against them because the people of all the other nationalities were afraid of them, and all the nobles of the provinces and satraps and governors and kings and administrators helped the Jews for fear of Mordecai had seized them. Mordecai is now the number two man in the empire. So now it's like, no matter how they felt before, if Haman was the number two guy, they would side with him. But now Mordecai is the number two guy, so they're going to side with him. So, this edict sort of showed which side the king is on. So you got to realize there's, a lot of politics and fear, and, these people suddenly are not just these innocent bystanders. Now they are powerful in and of their own selves. And because this is Mordecai was prominent in the palace, and his reputation spread throughout the provinces, and he became more and more powerful. The more and more, the reputation spreads, and every time the reputation spreads, it gets a little bigger. Like the fish that got away goes from here to here, And on that day, the Jews struck down all their enemies with the sword, killing and destroying them, and did what they pleased with those who hated them. In the citadel of Susa, Jews killed and destroyed 500 men. They also killed, names off all of these people, the 10 sons of Haman and the enemy of the Jews. But they did not lay their hands on the plunder of Haman, because the plunder of Haman is basically Esther's already, so they had killed them. And it says, the number of those slain in the city was reported to the king that day, and the king said to Esther, "The Jews have killed and destroyed 500 men and the 10 sons of Haman in the citadel of Susa. What have they done in the rest of the king's provinces? Now what is your petition? It will be given to you. What is your request? It will also be granted." Now, in verse 7, it says they killed, and names off these guys who were the 10 sons of Haman. Okay. Now, what he's going to do is explain that. Okay, understand what's happening. Because once the 500 were killed, attacking the Jews in Susa, the king goes, "Okay, this is what happens. What is your request?" And she says, "If it pleases your king, give the Jews in Susa permission to carry out this day's edict tomorrow also, and let Haman's 10 sons be hanged on the gallows." So the king commanded that this be done, and an edict was issued, and they hanged the 10 sons of Haman. The Jews in Susa came together on the 14th day of the month of Adar, and they put to death in Susa 300 men. They did not lay their hands on the plunder. And then the rest of the province, it says they killed 75,000 but did not lay their hands on the plunder. They killed them, but they never didn't steal. They had permission to, but they didn't. Steal all their goods. Yeah. If somebody, the head of a household, decided to join the group that was going to attack the Jews and he was killed in battle, they could go to his house and, take his family as slaves. They could take everything he owned. Everything he owned now belonged to them. But the Jews didn't do that. They weren't interested in the plunder, which, probably blew the king away. Now the question is, why would beautiful, nice Queen Esther ask that the 10 sons of Haman be killed? Yeah, they are going to come after revenge. And you've got to remember, there's a side to the Jewish people that goes way back, in history, that time and time again, people have tried to destroy them. And every time people have tried to destroy them, they are here, this big group is here, and they win, and this whole group gets destroyed. It's always total victory. And and Joshua is that way. And you read that the conquest of Israel. Israel's ongoing problems all the way to the kingdom, and the reason they end up losing the land is because they didn't do what Joshua was told to do, which was kill everybody. Take this paganism out of the land totally. They didn't do that. It was total victory. And And that's the history. And there's a, yeah, Mount Carmel, the same thing. And just look at it now. You've got Israel. You've got 9 million Jews in Israel or 6 million Jews in Israel, and they're taking on all the Arab world, and you don't mess with them. You know? You take out one of theirs, they're going to take out a bunch of yours. You know? So that reputation has been with this people all the way along, and this is part of it. So it's a total victory. But what was amazing, I think, to the king is that they never touched the plunder. They never went back and took their families or anything. If the guys attacked them, they died. If they didn't, they were left alone. And to the point of 75,000 people tried to do that in the course of all of that was going on. But then what happened was, in Susa, the Jews assembled on the 13th and 14th. Then on the 15th day, they rested and made it a day of feasting and joy. So after the attacks were over and they defended themselves, because the people only had one day to do this. That was the idea. They had one day to do it. And Queen Esther, the attacking force, had one day to do it. The Jews had one day to defend themselves. So she asked for a second day to make sure that Haman's family, his sons were taken out. There'd be no revenge, no seeking after that, no generational thing going on. And then the next day, they declared it a day of feasting. Mordecai recorded those events. And he says that's why the rural Jews, those living in villages, observed the 14th day of the month of Adar, the day of joy and feasting, the day of giving presents to one another. And Mordecai wrote all of these things down and sent it throughout all over the empire, including Israel, and the feast of Purim was born. And the Jews today still celebrate the feast of Purim in the spring. You know? So why was Esther recorded even though God is never mentioned? You know, well, God is probably never mentioned because all of those who chose to go back to Israel had already gone back to Israel, and they chose not to. So more of a cultural Jew than anything else. But at the same time, the Feast of Purim is still celebrated today. You know, so this gives us a biblical foundation for when your Jewish friends are celebrating Purim in the spring, this is what it's all about. This is where it comes from. It's rooted in history. All of those things, you know, he recorded everything. He recorded the whole thing to make sure, and that's probably how we have it. God has a way of protecting his people even when they aren't, you don't read anything about him doing it. He always works behind the scenes, and he certainly did that, you know. And Purim exists today. And if for no other reason, Esther would be recorded, because even though God isn't mentioned, why do the Jews celebrate Purim today? Yeah, there are feast days that the Jews celebrate that are regulated in the Old Testament, in the law. And the Day of Atonement and all kinds of things are all there, and we can see that, and they practice all of that. But there's a couple of Jewish holidays that are practiced and celebrated today, and they are particularly days of celebration and joy that don't have anything to do with Israel. You know, one of them is Purim, what happened with Esther and the King Xerxes and saving the people and the day of celebration. So here's a historical celebration of that. Doesn't have anything to do with the law. It's not written in the law. But the Jews still practice it today. Anybody know what the other one is? Hanukkah, Festival of Lights. Because that had to do with between the New Testaments and the Maccabean revolt and the history of what happened there. It's anchored in history. It's still being celebrated 2,000 years later, but it's not an Old Testament thing. It's not a law thing. It's not something that God ordained in that sense. It's just a celebration of the people for the victory God gave them. So what we have here is perhaps suddenly, why? You know, there are probably any number of times in history the Jews have been threatened to be extinguished, for lack of a better term, and God has intervened. But we have a couple of times that it's recorded, you know, even though God isn't mentioned. Well, why? Because the Jews are celebrating Purim now. And in the spring, they're going to celebrate it again. And it's all about this story. Only now they do recognize that God was behind it. They recognize that in retrospect, even though that's nowhere reflected in anything that Mordecai wrote. You know, Mordecai just celebrates the victory. We did it. You know, we don't have any sense of these people being particularly religious. You know, but they were culturally Jews, and God worked to protect them too, because in protecting them, He protected all of the Jews in Israel who were rebuilding the temple and rebuilding the wall and rebuilding the city and reestablishing the nation and all of those things. And God has a way of doing that. So, anyway, that's sort of how this all comes to a conclusion. You know, that's sort of the end of the story. You know, the Jews come, they have the land, they lose the land, they're taken into captivity, some of them come back, but even those who are left who don't come back to be faithful to God and reestablish that are still protected by the Lord, even in the midst of it. God is always watching out for His people, even when His people aren't paying Him a whole lot of attention. And that should be comforting. It should be comforting. So, Father, thank You for recording and keeping this book in here. It's so important for us to understand that and to grasp, Lord, how important it is. And even though, Father, You aren't mentioned and aren't given the credit, the Jews do that now. And they celebrate the victory and protection that You gave them. So, Father, we want to just celebrate, too, because we know that there are many, many times, an unknown number of times for all of us, when You have protected us and saved us, and maybe we weren't even aware of it. We praise You for that, and we just want to thank You for Your grace and Your protection. In Jesus' name.